Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dr. David DeCoss, Director of Campus Ethics Programs at the Markela Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, and your moderator for today's program. This program is part of the Commonwealth Club's series on ethics and accountability, underwritten by the Charles Travers family. Tonight, we will focus on a topic that, in a sense, has always been with us, but is taking on today new force: cheating. Cheating has become more common in nearly every sector of our society, business, education, sports, and beyond. From the highly publicized corporate scandals to Little League fraud, unethical behavior has risen dramatically in the last two decades. Why all this cheating, and why now? Is it a dog-eat-dog economic climate that causes it? How much have rising economic inequality and insecurity contributed to cheating? Have Americans lost faith in the social contract and in the rules governing society so that they feel more licensed to cheat and make up their own rules? Does cheating threaten the existence of American democracy? Does the weakness of American democracy invite cheating? To discuss this subject in depth, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, Dr. David Callahan, founder of the public policy research organization Demos and author of the best-selling book, The Cheating Culture. David has been called a new liberal with old values. His work explores classic liberal concerns, for instance, the effects of markets on political and social life. But he does this with an especially keen eye for how markets instill and influence our moral values. In addition to The Cheating Culture, David has also written The Moral Center: How Progressives Can Unite America Around Our Shared Values, and his latest book, Fortunes of Change: The Rise of the Liberal Rich and the Remaking of America. He is a regular commentator on television and radio programs and a frequent public speaker. He received his BA at Hampshire College and his PhD in politics at Princeton University. Please join me in welcoming Dr. David Callahan.
Good to be here.
David, nice to see you again and all.
Nice to see you.
Thought we might start with a few general questions to get us into more familiar with the argument of your book. So cheating has been around for a long time, of course, going back to, is it Adam and Eve, Esau and Jacob? I'm not sure where it all got going. But what's different about cheating now that makes it a special problem and that prompted you to write The Cheating Culture?
Well, before answering that question, let me just say a big thanks to the Commonwealth Club for having me here. When the book was first published, I spoke at the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley, which was very exciting. But this, you know, has always been the goal. So I'm very pleased to be here, particularly thankful to the President Gloria Duffy for her interest in my book, and George Dobbins and the other staff who put this together, and also the Travers family for their really important support for discussion of these issues. They're very important. So yes, cheating has always been around, and this is not a new sort of human phenomenon. And certainly cheating's always been around in the United States. I mean, this is a very kind of rough and tumble country in many ways. Our history is one filled with, you know, gunslingers and cowboys and wildcatters and, you know, mafias and organized criminals and, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff. So the argument in my book, though, is that, you know, cheating tends to sort of wax and wane. If you think back historically, there have been these sort of periods with a lot of cheating, you know, like the robber baron era, the go-go 20s. But then there's been these other periods where the country was sort of more morally upright, more sort of pulled together and with stronger sense of social solidarity. I think of the period after World War II. The last 30 years has been a period of, I think, a tremendous amount of and growing level of cheating, and we can go through and talk about all the different areas. And the argument of the book is that, you know, there is this natural tendency to cheat, and it's been, in the last 30 years, a lot of the incentives to cheat have really grown. Rational incentives to cut corners, to get ahead professionally, academically, financially. I talk about sort of four main incentives. One, the rewards for the winners are so much bigger than ever before. You know, we hear all the time about inequality, all the wealth at the top. Well, that has big implications for our ethics because, you know, if the rewards are so great, it's more rational to cut corners to get them, whether it's a baseball player taking steroids to get paid $20 million as opposed to $1 million 20 years ago, or somebody on Wall Street or what have you. Second big incentive is that the sticks are hitting harder for everybody else. So not only are the carrots bigger, but the sticks are hitting harder. More insecurity, more anxiety about within the middle class, about just sort of keeping, you know, lots of talk about the middle class being under tremendous amount of pressure. That has implications for our ethics. Third big incentive, the watchdogs have been asleep. People cheat more when there's fewer people trying to catch them. So whether it's the, you know, campuses that turned a blind eye to cheating, or Major League Baseball, which didn't have a drug testing policy for many years, or, you know, the IRS not having enough tax enforcement agents, or the SEC not keeping a handle on what's going on Wall Street. I mean, wherever you find a lot of cheating, you find sleeping watchdogs. Fourth incentive, which is the culture, has become very much of a me-first, highly individualistic culture where there's a lot of focus on money and a lot of focus on status and not much focus on what are you doing to make the world a better place or how are you helping others. And, you know, it's a Paris Hilton culture, you know, Donald Trump Paris Hilton culture with this sort of intense individualism. And that gives people sort of license to cheat. And when there's less sort of social opprobrium for cheating, then there's more incentives to cheat. So you stir all that together and you get this cheating culture that I talk about in my book. And once you have a lot of cheating, that itself creates incentives to cheat. Because if you're looking around and you're seeing all this cheating, you think, well, why should I be the saint who dots every I and crosses every T? You know, why should I be the chump who follows every rule if, you know, there's all this cheating going on? So that's sort of the thumbnail sketch of the book.
David, I'm wondering, following up on that, you've identified these structural incentives, structural forces.
Yeah.
Could you speak a little more about how you see the role of personal responsibility in cheating now? I think we tend to think of cheating as an individual matter, not so much a social matter. So where does personal responsibility stand in the face of these social incentives that invite cheating?
Yeah, well, you know, cheating is a choice. Nobody has to cheat. You can decide not to cheat. Many people do. Most people, perhaps, depending upon what area you're looking at. And so there's a big role for personal responsibility, and I think there's a big role for the family and community in sort of teaching ethics and instilling this. But you know, we've lived in a funny time where the idea of personal responsibility has been typically discussed in the context of social issues, right? It's been personal responsibility around sex and drugs and violent crime. There hasn't been a lot of focus in kind of resisting the pressures to cut corners to get ahead when it comes to financial or academic success. You know, parents have been told again and again, talk to your kids about sex, talk to your kids about drunk driving, talk to your kids about drugs. Well, When's the last time anybody ever suggested to parents, talk to your kids about integrity, talk to your kids about how to stand up to the pressures of materialism, you know, this kind of individualism in this materialism. So I think we've had a very kind of narrow definition of what moral values are in this country, and a very kind of, and it's a debate that I think needs to be broadened. It's not that all those social issues that we focused on don't matter, but all these other issues about ethics and integrity do matter as well. In terms of the you know, these structural issues, they're big and they're powerful. You know, I tend to say that when people, if you give people a choice between, on the one hand, this very concrete thing, which is financial security and success, and on the other hand, this sort of amorphous, important to people, but amorphous thing of personal integrity and ethics, when people perceive those in sort of direct competition, some portion of people will go for financial security over their personal integrity. And we can talk about this in particular when it comes to academic cheating, because students value integrity but are very worried about success.
David, you spoke at the start about cheating waxing and waning. And I'm thinking, and the book came out, is it 2004?
Uh-huh.
And since then, I mean, the book came out in 2004. Your analysis identified these social factors hinged very much on market forces inviting cheating. Since then, we've had the financial collapse. We've had Citizens United. We've had very few people in the middle of the financial collapse face any consequences for their actions. Is cheating getting worse now? Is it just sort of running amok now, or are we? Is there a bright light here somewhere?
Well, let's focus on the bright light, because there is some good news here in the past 8 years or so. There have been some areas where we've made progress, and I'll name a couple. Major League Baseball and steroids. This was an area with widespread cheating for years. Steroid use was epidemic, to the point that, you know, there's some estimates that 40 to 50% of players were using steroids. So, you know, all those baseball statistics from the late 90s and early 2000s, we might just have to sort of put a big asterisk next to. Really disturbing, you know, the great American pastime. But, you know, the John McCain, other senators sort of pushed for reform. We have Major League Baseball got serious. They enacted a drug testing policy, still not as tough as it should be. There was criminal prosecutions. The, you know, federal agents went after some of these people. You know, that, so that's an area where there's been progress. I'll give you another. When I wrote my book, the conflicts of interest around doctors with pharmaceutical companies was sort of just breaking, and I wrote about it quite extensively in my book. These doctors who were kind of taking money from pharmaceutical companies to promote one drug over the other, you know, basically putting their own financial interests above the interests of their patients, which is very disturbing. Sort of the pharmaceutical industry corrupting a profession which is the most respected and trusted profession in America in some pretty deep ways. But since 2004, there's been a whole spate of reforms. You know, the Senate, Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, has been leading investigations of this area. Medical schools have passed these conflict of interest policies. Stanford passed a big conflict of interest policy with its doctors. There's been, you know, state-level investigations of this stuff, new awareness, new rules, pushback. And I think also in the area of academic integrity, you know, that is not an area where there's been improvement, but there's a kind of a movement of students growing and professors who care about this stuff, who don't want to see all this cheating in our schools. And a few other areas, but there's been some real a pushback to this cheating culture, and I think we have made some progress. Of course, one could argue that the housing bubble and the financial crisis, which was rife from cheating at every single level, kind of nullifies all of that progress, but You know, I do think that there's a sort of two steps forward, one step back kind of process. The stuff does wax and wane. And one of my sort of broad, where I conclude my book, I argue that, you know, these periods of sort of moral free-for-all in American society where greed and excessive individualism kind of careens out of control are almost always followed by this kind of push, this moral pushback. I mean, Americans are very moralistic people, and we really believe in a level playing field. And we really believe that this should be a society of fair rules. I mean, that kind of egalitarianism runs deep. We see ourselves as highly ethical people, in contrast to the old world where kind of corruption was baked into the system of aristocracy. So there's always this kind of pushback whenever this, you know, whether it's the progressives who fought against the excesses of the robber baron era or the New Dealers who fought back against the excesses of the go-go 20s. And I think that we're seeing some of that makings of that today. And I keep waiting for it to gain more momentum. But I think that that's sort of the cycle of American history. Excess, reform, excess, reform.
Well, David, we have some very interesting audience questions. And a couple of them raise questions about whether morality is just inherently morally relative, so to speak, if it's relativist, or if morality is something always externally imposed by society. And I'm actually wondering if you might speak about what has influenced most your own moral perspective in terms of how you sort of brought that perspective to analyzing cheating in the book and today.
Yeah. Well, I have often said that I'm kind of the accidental ethicist because I started writing this book after my previous book was about the Harvard Business School class of 1949, which was this sort of famous group of business school graduates. And when I was finishing that book, the Enron scandal broke, and I got interested in corporate ethics and then interested in ethics more broadly. So I thought I was sort of the accidental ethicist. Of course, that is a total lie because my parents are both sort of in this business. My father founded a think tank on medical ethics, bioethics, and my mother is a psychologist, writes about religion. They were both heavily influenced by kind of Catholic, social justice Catholic work in the 1960s. And so I sort of grew up with a concern around moral issues and had that as a kind of a backdrop in sort of my own intellectual development.
David, when you speak of the things that have improved of late, certainly they all involve some dimension of market forces, say, with doctors' offices, pharmaceuticals. But it does seem that if we look at the financial crash, that the financial world of financial markets remains a pretty hard nut to crack in terms of cheating, in terms of, say, the resistance to Dodd-Frank these days and effort to sort of corral things. What is it about the world, the sort of pure world of markets and finance, that makes it a particularly tough nut to crack in terms of issues of cheating?
Well, I mean, this is an area where, as I said, the carrots have gotten bigger for winners. I mean, this is an area where the carrots have gotten really big for winners. And that creates temptations. I think that there's an element of human nature of would you risk indictment and 3 years in a minimum security prison for $3 million? Maybe not. For $50 million? How about for $300 million, you know? And it's the rewards have become a lot greater. And as well, I think that there's sort of these persistent new gray areas that emerge where things are sort of clearly wrong or morally suspect, but regulation has not caught up yet. So I'm thinking of the whole mortgage-backed securities of, you know, taking these subprime loans and bundling them together and kind of turning a blind eye to, you know, the problems with some of these loans. And, one big reason very few people have been indicted is because a lot of this stuff is not technically illegal, right? But it's clearly bad. And I think that finance, which has been so innovative, where things keep changing all the time, has been an area where there's a lot of that, a lot of those gray areas. So big rewards and large gray areas and sleeping watchdogs. I mean, the Securities and Exchange Commission, you know, you take an agency, you downsize it for 30 years, you have lawyers making $125,000 going up against, you know, the best law firms in the world with endless resources to protect, you know, the people who are engaged in some of this stuff. It's not a fair fight, you know. Just to give you one example, back in the first round of financial scandals when the earnings, these companies were misstating their earnings, you know, inflating what their earnings were, jacking up how much money they were making in order to jack up their stock value. So the head of the enforcement of the SEC gave a speech in 2000. He said, we only review 15% of the filings of public companies every year. So we don't actually know what's going on with the other 85% because that's all the staff capacity we have, right? So, you know, then if you're inflating your earnings, it's a little like you're gambling that you won't get caught, and it's a pretty good gamble. You know, I mentioned in my book that in the late 1990s, there was a lot of anecdotal reports coming out about inflated earnings with Silicon Valley companies. There were so many incentives to inflate earnings; the stock market was going crazy. And at that time, there was exactly one, like, assistant U.S. attorney in Silicon Valley who was in charge of white-collar crime. So it's like this one, and he had, like, you know, a couple staff members or something, and, you know, this one completely overworked guy in the face of hundreds of companies that were engaged in these shenanigans, and these are not fair fights. And I could talk about tax evasion, which is sort of a similar dynamic of extremely sophisticated cheating and extremely overtaxed regulators.
David, your book has been criticized by some on the more libertarian side of thinking that you have not perhaps been fair to the workings of the market in some respects. And we have a question here that in some ways picks up that uh-huh. sentiment, which is, do you think that as the government has taken on more enforcement responsibility in our culture, this has enforced a mindset of trying to get away with cheating because individual responsibility is not stressed? I wonder if you could speak to that criticism, please, or that question.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely something to that. If you live in if regulatory climate is such that there's rule around everything, and there's not a lot of emphasis sort of culturally about responsibility, then people are just focused on what are the rules. And if something is in a gray area, like I mentioned, maybe they think that's okay. There's a big debate in accounting about, you know, should you have broad principles that are supposed to guide people's ethics, or should you have really detailed rules? But I want to make a broader point about the questions about whether I'm going too hard on the market, which is that I think that free enterprise capitalism is a fantastic system for creating wealth. It is unrivaled. It is phenomenal. It is the goose that lays the golden egg. And I also think that capitalism and markets make us virtuous in many ways, right? The people who work hard and have great ideas and all that should be the people who get ahead. And markets allow that. And they really reward hard work, and they reward virtue. And ideally, they create a real meritocratic system. But I think that the values that make the market work so well can also kind of go too far, right? Like, competition is a great value, right? Competition is great. It pushes everybody to do to do really well. But competition can easily also turn cutthroat. If you have too much competition, too much pressure on people, they feel like, God, there's a gun to my head. I better, you know, and that creates sort of temptations to cut corners and be unethical, which I document in my book. Or take another value of the market, efficiency. Efficiency is great. You know, you want to wring out all of the kind of waste in a system, and you want to kind of, you know, make things run as smoothly as possible. And the market does that very well. But again, if you have this sort of relentless focus on cost cutting and efficiency and meet your numbers and meet your quotas, I mean, there's all sorts of cheating scandals that I documented in my book on my website where, like, you know, the people up at the top of some corporate empire are telling the people in the middle, like, you know, hit your numbers, get, you know, and bad things happen. You know, they cut corners. There's a famous case where the Sears auto repair shop, where they instituted a quota system of, you know, the mechanics were no longer just paid a flat fee. Instead, they were paid how many cars they fixed. And suddenly, Sears auto shops were ripping people off left and right and got because people were making up these repairs. And, you know, all sorts of scandals where, like, efficiency leads people to behave badly. I think inequality is another is another thing in the market that can be virtuous. Yes, the people who do have better ideas and work harder and all of that should get paid more money. Inequality is a good thing. You want inequality to motivate people. But if you have the people at the top getting paid an insane amount of money, that can make the people in the middle feel sort of envious and, you know, sort of shift wealth upwards and it can bring out, you know, the worst in people in terms of them cutting corners to get those big carrots. So all of this is sort of a dual-edged sword when it comes to the market. And, you know, I don't have a beef with capitalism. I just think that in the last 30 years we have not got the balance right. We need a balance here, and we've sort of gone too far and taken those market values too far, and they've become, I think, the enemy of morals and values that all Americans hold dear. Not just liberals. It's not just liberals whose values are being kind of steamrolled by these market excesses. It's conservatives care about a lot of these values too. And so I think we've had sort of an overly polarized debate about the market.
David, just now and in your books, really, you make very persuasive cases for the role of market forces in changing, eroding our sense of moral values. We have a number of questions about other sort of forces commonly associated with the loss or decline of moral value. And I'm wondering if you could comment on these other forces. And in particular here, we have two questions about organized religion and the assumption that is organized religion, is its declining role in our society in a public way in some respects, causing us to lose a sense of moral value that's in turn causing us to cheat more?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I guess I would like to preface that question by noting an interesting dichotomy when it comes to moral behavior in America in the last 20 years, which is on the one hand, there's been a lot of areas where people's moral behavior have improved quite substantially. Crime is down dramatically. I mean, New York City, where I live, is now safer than it's been since, like, 1960. Teen pregnancy is now down to its lowest level in 60 years. And one reason for that is teenagers are having less sex. Teenagers have, like, 20% less sex, or less likely to have sex now than in the 1980s or 1970s. Smoking is down. Alcohol use and binge drinking is down. Drunk driving deaths have dropped by, I think it's 40% since the early 1980s. You know, the divorce rate is down by 20%. I mean, in many ways, this society has become more sort of morally reflective, more responsible, more socially prudent in recent years, with crime, the decline of crime being the biggest, most notable indicator there. Yet, at the same time, there's been this all this cheating to get ahead academically, professionally, and financially. I tend to, the image that always comes to my mind is that people are going through life with these kind of two separate moral compasses. They got their one compass that guides their behavior when it comes to, you know, violence or sex or drunk driving or drugs or smoking or alcohol. And then they have a seemingly a different moral compass when it comes to, you know, doing well in school and, you know, filing their taxes and, you know, putting in their earnings reports with the SEC, or, you know, the, when it comes to the sort of sphere of money and financial competition. So you cannot look at the cheating in American society and say, well, that's evidence that our society is just going down the tubes morally across the board. You know, this is just a society in moral decline, because that is not the case. We have, you know, two different lines on the graph. And I think that the reason that the, you know, that we're seeing all the cheating in the financial and economic areas because of these structural trends. In terms specifically of the role of religion, you know, there's, on the one hand, you look at the highly, some of the most secular societies on earth, like the Scandinavian societies, are the least corrupt societies. Much less cheating, much less corruption than the United States. So you cannot, you know, say, well, there's a direct correlation. On the other hand, I've seen interesting research suggesting that people with a strong sort of theistic orientation, like students, young people, are less likely to cheat in school. That people who believe, young people and students who believe in God are less likely to cheat. And I do think that the decline of religion in the United States and the absence of any kind of new sort of other kinds of institution to take its place has had a negative impact on our moral life. No question about it.
I think it's very striking to me just what you're saying, thinking about even contemporary discussions at the national level, international level, when the Pope issues a major statement on the economy. It's often really rejected as sort of not being the Pope's business or bishop's business or other church leaders' business to talk about the economy. I wonder if that also indicates the gap that you're talking about, some effort here to sort of recombine a world of those sorts of values with our economic life. Certainly, yeah, it was a concern going back in history of all the great sort of thinkers, religious and otherwise, to talk about property and markets and prices.
Yeah, it needs to be. I mean, all of these moral issues, whether it's you know, divorce and drugs, the kind of traditional social conservative agenda, or whether it's kind of greed and cheating, I think they all need to be treated in a holistic way, as opposed to kind of compartmentalized. And I think that while in many ways I've admired conservatives for their ability to bring these moral issues into the debate over the past 30 years and stick with them, and I think that you know, liberals, people on the left, have tended to think about the economy mainly in material terms, like how does it affect people's standard of living, not tend to think so much about the moral implications. And so there's the need for some sort of still some work in that area.
David, you identify that the sort of desire to emulate others, keep up with the Joneses, what have you, has gotten out of hand as a real incentive to cheating in our world. And a very interesting question here about the role of television and movies and their image of success. How has the image of success in those media, do you think, influenced this go-get-it without any cost sort of mentality we have?
Well, one of the things I notice whenever I watch TV or see a movie for that matter is that people always, especially if it's set in New York, they're always living in apartments that no normal person can afford. And which inherently makes you feel bad for yourself if you're not living in that similar kind of apartment. Or, you know, it seems like Hollywood movies, the couple's always living in some big, beautiful house that, you know, most people couldn't afford. There's so much depiction of wealth in the media. It's just like, you know, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous used to be a show that aired once a week. And now I feel like it's 24/7 on television, right? It's just like this constant kind of glamorization or focus on the wealthy and on celebrities. And I think that makes people feel I know that that, I mean, studies have shown, makes people feel inadequate about themselves and about their own sort of material situation, their own social status. And I think that that sense of, you know, we don't talk about envy much as being a social problem, but envy is actually a really poisonous emotion. I mean, think of when you sort of felt it yourself. It's like envy is a really poisonous sort of emotion. It brings out bad vibes and behaviors in people. And I think that we live in a society soaked in envy. I mean, you can't get away with it. And so combine that with the sort of structural incentives and the kind of permissiveness that the people who cut corners tend to be often forgiven, right? They get moral. I have a whole chapter in my book about sort of people's comebacks. You know, like they get indicted or they go to prison, and the next thing you know, they're back and they're like Martha Stewart, like slimmer and richer than ever. You know? And their show has even more viewers, right? Or Michael Milken, you know, one moment they're the disgraced face of Wall Street greed, and the next moment they're like a, you know, leading philanthropist and, you know, a public intellectual. And so I think that there's it's not just that there's a lot of envy, there's also a tremendous amount of cynicism, a feeling of like that people do bad things and then they get punished, but then they're forgiven. Or people do bad things, but then they don't get punished. And, you know, there's a poll, and I think young people definitely see this and pick this up. There's there's this regular poll every 2 years of high school students, and one of the questions they ask is, do you think that, you know, successful people sometimes cheat? Or, you know, that cheating is part of how you become successful in American society. And I can't remember the exact figure, but I think it was like 43% in the 2010 poll said yes, that successful people get there by cheating. Now, where do young people get that idea? Turning on the news, maybe? I mean, there's so much of this. And now this, and so that makes young people feel like, well, maybe that is how society works. You know, maybe, you know, that's the way it is in this, and that I need to cheat too, or cheating is normal. I shouldn't be the chump who dots every I and crosses every T. So the cynicism is pretty intense right now.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is Dr. David Callahan, founder of the policy organization Demos and author of the book The Cheating Culture. Dr. Callahan is discussing what he says is an epidemic of cheating in American society. David, I'm wondering if we could return to your reference in your last comment to children, students, and all. And just imagining a scenario with a parent reading your book, being extremely concerned about raising their children in this world. What's your boilerplate counsel to such parents, in terms of how they might deal with influences, sort of invite their child to think differently about cheating?
Yeah. That is a tough challenge for any parent. I think that the most important thing that a parent can do is talk to their children about this stuff. I mean, it's amazing how this issue, which is so big, is often not really part of the family conversation. I mean, I think that the family is a totally important kind of first line of defense here. And yet this is not, you know, parents, as I mentioned earlier, you know, they'll talk to their kids about drugs or sex or drunk driving or other stuff, but these issues aren't necessarily on the kind of kitchen table agenda. I also think that parents and other institutions that deal with educate young people need to continually introduce kids to other sorts of role models, right? So we live in a Paris Hilton Donald Trump 24/7 media culture, and you know, the people who are in fighting AIDS in Rwanda or something, or rebuilding New Orleans, don't get much press, right? And so it can be easy if you're young people to think that, well, it's just like those are the only, that's what matters, right? And I think it's very important to continually expose young people to the kind of real heroes of our society who are making a contribution and giving back, and also to give young people an opportunity to do that kind of stuff themselves. And that's another area where we're making progress. There's so much more community service programs that in colleges and high school than ever before. People like to poo-poo that stuff. Oh, it's just, you know, a bunch of kids trying to, you know, burnish their resumes. But a lot of the stuff is real engagement of young people in going out and being involved in society's problems. And that is like a great anecdote to this cheating culture, because that's about helping others, and cheating is about helping yourself and sort of letting your individualism be dominant.
David, in your book, you speak at length about cheating in schools, high schools, colleges, and all. And we have a question here, and I'll read this. I think it really speaks for itself. I came to this country 30 years ago and was shocked to see that students would take exams without a teacher or faculty present. Now we hear about teachers cheating and giving answers to their students. Have we come to a new level of loss of ethics in our colleges and high schools?
Things are bad. you teach on the campus. You know this. So the survey research, it's pretty depressing in this area. Between two-thirds and three-quarters of high school and college students acknowledge some cheating within the past year. And that's like a substantial majority of students who are cheating. And I've been to a lot of campuses, and there's some places where there's not much cheating at all, for sure. Like, there's some bright spots. They often tend to be sort of small liberal arts colleges. But at the big universities and the big high schools, there tends to be just sort of rampant cheating. And we've all heard about this case in Berkeley with the hacking. And unfortunately, you hear about these cases a lot. We just, on the East Coast, we had this SAT case of students who were had paid somebody to take their SAT for them and were arrested. And that's a sort of big scandal on Long Island. So I do think that we've reached a low point. And as I see it, these young people are very much influenced by the society in which we live. So they're growing up with parents who don't talk about ethics. They're growing up in this news media culture. They're cynical. And more than ever, they feel like they have a gun to their heads when it comes to academic competition and success. You know, that they hear again and again, if you don't get into a good college, you're in big trouble. And, you know, this mania around getting into a good college is very out of control, particularly in these more affluent high schools. And once you're in a college, so it's not surprising you get a lot of high-achieving students who cheat. You know, like these Berkeley students, some of them were like the best students. I saw a study which found that 80% of students in Who's Who and American students, the so-called A, most of whom had A averages, had admitted some cheating. There's a lot of successful students who cheat, trying to get that GPA just a little better to increase their chances of getting into the name brand school, which in turn increases their chances of getting a job at Microsoft or wherever. And these students are not completely deluded either. I mean, Microsoft is a good example. For many years, I don't know what the policy is now, Microsoft only recruited from the top 10 science universities in America. So if you didn't get into one of those top science universities, you never had a chance to become a Microsoft millionaire. My bet is that Facebook and Google are sort of have similar kinds of recruiting policies. Goldman Sachs, that these big employers often let the colleges do the sifting for them. And so It's not completely, I tell students all the time, oh, don't worry where you go to school, but it's not completely irrational. And then once you're in college, the debt, the loans, the financial pressure is just crazy compared to when many of us went to college. And a lot of those scholarships and loans are contingent on GPA and, you know, maintaining certain levels of academic success. And students are working jobs off campus because they need to in order to pay, you know, for their schooling, so they don't have as much time to study, and so that creates time pressures. So again, you know, you're stirring all this stuff in. There's the culture, there's the structural things, and it comes together, I think, in some very troubling ways and helps explain these epidemic levels of cheating in our schools.
I was very struck in your book in the discussion of cheating at colleges and universities. I mean, from my experience at Santa Clara, where we work and are very concerned about this topic, and I think your discussion in the book where you say having an honor code may be a great thing, but unless it's really accompanied by a much stronger institutional commitment, it may well do very, very little.
Right.
I wonder if you could comment on that, because I think that is really the linchpin, in my view, in terms of universities. How strong is the commitment of a whole university to that honor code?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's no question that just having a bunch of words in the back of the student handbook that nobody, you know, ever actually reads is not going to do much for your ethics climate on campus, right? It's like this stuff really needs to be part of the culture. And in a lot of places, it just isn't. A lot of places don't even have an honor code. You know, I go to schools that have like 80% of the students are cheating. They don't have an honor code. But then in a lot of places that do have an honor code, they just it's sort of in the back of the, you know, it's not front and center. And I think that the one of the real keys is the strength of community in a college campus. Like the stronger the community is, the less likely you are to have a cheating culture. Because, I mean, this is kind of like social contract 101. Like people, if people feel like they're part of a community, that they helped kind of create and they helped sort of create the rules and maintain the rules, and they feel like the rules really reflect their values, they're less likely to break the rules. If they are in and if they're in a place where they know each other, they know their faculty, they know their professors, they have relationships, it makes it harder to cheat. But in a lot of campuses today, there's not that kind of community. These big universities, these schools with lots of commuting students, you know, professors who are in these gigantic classes don't even know their kids. Nobody knows that the professors don't know their student's name. I mean, that's how a lot of people are being educated today, and I think that that's a recipe for cheating. And it's not clear how easily you can create community in a lot of these situations. It's easy to create community at Williams College or Amherst College or one of these small liberal arts colleges. It's harder to do it at, you know, some, you know, big sprawling campus.
I'm very struck in your mentioning the creation of moral community at a college. And toward the end of your book, when you speak about, well, what are our solutions to the situation of cheating that we face, and you propose a new social contract, that you discuss there also really in a more of a national way.
Yeah.
As one of the planks of that, the creation of a sense that we really, I read it as, we actually belong in some way to each other.
Yeah.
A moral community.
Yeah.
Could you speak more about why that idea is so important to you?
Yeah. My book is mainly like filled with lots of bad news, but then there's the required solutions chapter in the end. And the way I think about the solutions is, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's like not rocket science, right? You want less cheating on campuses. You know, I think that you need to expel more students for cheating. You need to have an honor code. You need to strengthen community. You want less athletes taking drugs, test them for drugs. You want less, fewer people cheating on Wall Street, strengthen the SEC. You want less tax evasion, get more tax agents. You want, you know, I could go on down the list. But ultimately, you will never have enough cops looking over enough people's shoulders to stop cheating. People, the only way to deal with this is people need to not cheat because they don't want to, because they feel they need to be self-policing. And the only way to get people to sort of police themselves is by making them, I think, strong moral education and family and sense of personal responsibility is important, but also to make them feel that they are part of a social contract and of a community, that they, as I said, that they feel like the rules reflect their interest, that they help make the rules, that would they play by the rules, they get ahead. When the rules are broken, they're enforced fairly. And if you think about the society we live in, a lot of people don't believe that. They don't believe they live in a real moral community. People don't believe the rules are fair. Everybody knows that if you have more money for a good lawyer, you're less likely to go to prison. Everybody knows that if you have lobbyists, you know, you can sort of bend the rules to serve your own interests. I mean, I don't think people believe the rules are fair in this society. People know that there's not a fair say in how the rules are made. You know, I don't think there's a lot of faith in our democracy right now. There's a sense that special interests and money have a much bigger role than ordinary people. Polls show that people don't believe that government really speaks for them. So there's that the social contract is, and a lot of people don't believe that if they play by the rules, they'll get ahead. You know, there's a lot of people feel like they do everything right and they're still being crunched by the economy, especially now. And I think so the social contract, when there's a large percentage of the population that doesn't believe that the rules work, the social contract is broken, and that's where we are now. And that creates that's like a formula for a moral free-for-all, because if people don't believe the rules are fair, what do? They start to make up their own rules, and they justify all sorts of stuff, you know? And, I mean, taxes is actually a great example of this. You know, a lot of people don't believe the tax system is fair, so they make up they cheat on their taxes. They feel like there's rich people benefit from loopholes. Why not take make up some of my own deductions? I could talk about that more. But so there's that cynicism has undermined the social contract, undermined the sense of we all live in one moral community. And until we get our hands around that problem and try to solve it, I think that, you know, we could do all the pragmatic sort of short-term solutions to cheating, but we'll still have a major problem in our hands.
Well, we're now ready to take some verbal questions as well, so please feel free to go to the microphone in the aisle if you have some questions. We have a bunch more good ones up here to go too, so... Ah, great.
My name is Shi Wang. I have a question for you, Dr. Callahan. How do you identify people like Madoff in the early stage so we can prevent what he did from happening?
Bernie Madoff? Yes, that is it would be good to not have any more Bernie Madoffs. I mean, at some level, whenever I think about Bernie Madoff, I think, well, that's a sort of an example. I mean, this guy was sort of pretty pathological, right? And even if you have much greater enforcement and, you know, stronger moral community and whatever, you're always going to have some of those kinds of people. And so there's no kind of ironclad defense against the Bernie Madoffs of the world. On the other hand, you know, when you look into that case in detail, you see how the Securities and Exchange Commission, like, dropped the ball repeatedly. And, you know, like, the guy who was trying to expose Bernie Madoff kind of gave them the case on a silver platter. Like, this is, like, take a look at this guy. And they didn't they didn't follow up. So I think that is an example of the need for stronger, more effective watchdogs and not having these, I don't want to run down government lawyers, but they're not like the people who work on the Wall Street firms. And also, remember I mentioned that the SEC only looked at 15% of the earnings of the reports of public companies. Well, there's another interesting figure, which is how often personal investment advisors, registered investment advisors, get audited or examined by the SEC. The SEC is supposed to go periodically to look at these investment advisors, like, oh, you're running somebody's money, you advise people on their money, like, let's take a look at, you know, whether you're legit. And the year Bernie Madoff was exposed, the SEC had only examined like 9% of all the 15,000 registered investment advisors in America. Maybe I got that number wrong. So the problem is, and now I think it's maybe up to 11%, but there's just not the money. So the problem is not actually, you know, the big Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme that's coming next. The problem is numerous Ponzi schemes. I have a page on my website called Ponzi Schemes, and it just goes on and on. 2010 Ponzi scheme, 2009 Ponzi schemes, 2008 Ponzi schemes. It just goes on and on and on. All these different Ponzi schemes, and that happens because of our weak regulatory system.
Yeah, what you haven't addressed is the 4% of the male population, less than the women, that are sociopathic. And these are the
4%
cheaters. They have, you know, no conscience. They have no moral compass. They're charming. They're, you know, engaging. I wish I had read it. There's a book called The Sociopath Next Door, which
yes,
really describes this.
I'm familiar with that.
So the question I have is, how do you determine these people, and then what do you do about them? Is there anything you can do about
them? Yeah. You know, I'm familiar with this book, The Sociopath Next Door, and yeah, that's her argument. 4% of people are just, you know, no amount of the better enforcement or, you know, better family background or better culture is gonna deal with them. You know, and how can you identify? I think she has some solutions for how to identify them, and I think that our criminal justice system needs to do a much better job at really identifying and taking the people who are real threats off of our streets. And it doesn't do that very well. I mean, there's so many people who commit crimes who get let go, both violent and serious property crimes. I mean, if you look at the closure rates of, and one reason for that is we have so many resources tied up in this war on drugs and in mass incarceration, and I think it's a real misplaced priority. We need to really refocus our criminal justice system on the really dangerous people and let the people who are a danger to themselves live in peace.
Yes, another question, please, sir.
Oh, thank you. I'm Otis Paul. In the cases of the financial incentivization to cheat, is it possible to put that shoe on the other foot, to somehow create regulation that would allow incentivization of the detection of cheating?
It's funny you should mention that, because I had coffee the other day with a guy who was a SEC assistant director, and while at the SEC, he had been the kind of architect of a new, the SEC's, the whistleblower statute that was part of Dodd-Frank, which provides financial bounties to anybody who uncovers securities fraud, the same way that there's financial bounties available to anybody who uncovers like fraud in defense contracting or government contracting. You've heard a lot about whistleblowers, the defense, you know, you identify cost overruns, you get a big, you know, slice of the settlement, which can be quite large. John Grisham once wrote a great thriller novel about the sort of set against that whistleblower law. So there's whistleblower. So now there's this new security. So he came to me and he was like, "Hey, you write about cheating. Maybe if you ever see any, send them my way, and maybe you could get a piece of the financial pie." I was like, "Oh, that's interesting." But I thought, "Gee, maybe I should quit my think tank job and go try to ferret out securities fraud." But that thought lasted till I got back to the office. But there's also a relatively new whistleblower statute for tax cheats. So if you expose tax cheating to the IRS and there's a settlement, you can get a percentage of that. So that incentivization of turning people in is definitely big driver of this whistleblower movement.
So we have another question. Yes.
Sir. 50 years ago, Wall Street firms were all partnerships, and now they're mostly corporations. Do you think that made a difference?
I do think it's made a difference. You know, you had these. This has been written about the guy who wrote the book on Goldman Sachs.
Lewis.
No, there's another book on more recent book on Goldman Sachs called "All the Money in the World." Or how Goldman Sachs runs the world, or something. Anyway, Goldman Sachs used to be a partnership, and it was if something went wrong in the firm, all the partners were sort of responsible. Now Goldman Sachs is a public corporation; nobody's particularly responsible. And when Goldman Sachs was fined $500 million by the SEC last year, guess who picks up the tab? The shareholders, right? As opposed to sort of the partners collectively being responsible for that, and also the way that becoming a corporation changes things is that, and this sort of speaks to a bigger problem in our capitalist system is you have a bunch of shareholders who are asking every single quarter, "Did you make money? Did you make more money than last quarter? Are you going to make more money, even more money next quarter? And you guys better make money every single quarter, more money every single quarter, and do whatever it takes to make that money." And that all that counts for the shareholders. And so this sort of rise of shareholder capitalism, I think, is a big problem here of sort of all these public companies under relentless pressure of, I've never particularly seen a lot of these executive types as evil or bad in any way. I see them as people responding to rational incentives, which is, the shareholders are breathing down your neck on the one hand. On the other hand, maybe if you cut a couple corners, you're going to get a $100 million compensation package because the stock went up. And all that, tying all that, your compensation to stock, I think has been very insidious too. So, definitely hit on a big point there.
Yes, sir. Another question.
Good evening, and thank you. Gary, a Malaysian. I've come to the conclusion that America incentivizes gluttony. And that mindset is what you're dealing with your book. Because it's not only that gluttony, but we're gluttonous in almost everything we do. And most of our institutions are dysfunctional because of gluttony.
I would like to be able to use that as a future insight, because I think that you're really onto something there, and I never really thought about it as incentivizing gluttony per se. But as soon as you mentioned it, I was like, yeah, actually, there's something to that. I mean, take the home mortgage interest deduction. The bigger the house you build, the bigger the deduction you get, right? So no wonder, I mean, there's sort of an incentive to build the biggest possible house and get the biggest mortgage. I mean, it's sort of baked into the system. Or, the more you spend on healthcare, the bigger the tax deduction you can get on your Schedule A, right? You know, the more healthcare you consume. And certainly when it comes to to actual food, you have the big food companies that have a a lot of influence over our politics. You know, there's all sorts of ways in which Americans are sort of being incentivized to be supersized, you know. I have to think some more about exactly how that relates to the cheating culture, but it definitely there's this culture of excess. In a culture of excess, sort of bad ethical things happen.
Well, that's all the time we have today. So our thanks to Dr. David Callahan, founder of the policy organization Demos and author of the book, The Cheating Culture. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club series on ethics and accountability, underwritten by the Charles Travers family. I'm Dr. David DeCoss of Santa Clara University, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Hey, David.
Thank you.
Super job.
Yeah.
Really.
Thank you.